The first prisoner said nothing as a pair of balaclava-clad SDF guards roughly dragged him into the interrogation room and manacled him to the table. The chain links pulled so tight he was forced to slump across it, his wrists stretched out. Trapp raised an eyebrow but said nothing. He scratched the side of his cheek with an extended index finger as one of the guards left the room. The other guard remained. The itch didn't fade. A thin manila folder rested on the table in front of him. Not the prisoner's. He reached down to the stack that sat on the floor to his left-hand side and plucked the topmost off it, spreading it out across its sibling. The inmate photo that stared up out of it could, just barely if you squinted in the right kind of light, be said to resemble the man chained opposite him. In the intake photo, the prisoner's head was covered in a thick carpet of black hair, and his beard had grown long. By contrast, this iteration's scalp had been roughly trimmed, and only a few days' stubble covered his chin.
"Your name is Mohammed, correct?"
Mohammed tossed his head back as far as the chains around his wrists allowed. Trapp saw what was coming an instant before it happened, but his chair leg caught the rough concrete ground and he was unable to push it back in time. He couldn't avoid the thick slug of saliva that the prisoner sent hurling through the air. It landed on his left cheek, thick and warm, and hung there for a few seconds before it started to drip.
"Delightful."
He reached into his pocket for a rag with which to clean himself. The guard sidestepped the table with surprising speed and slammed the prisoner's forehead against the steel. The ensuing crunch left no doubt as to the outcome for the soft cartilage and bone in his nose.
"Just take him."
"You don't want to talk? He will answer your questions, I promise."
"No, he won't."
The second guard returned, unlocked the prisoner's cuffs, and helped his buddy drag the insensible man away. Trapp leaned forward to wipe the blood from the table, and after a moment's consideration, decided to leave it where it was. He dumped the first file onto the floor on his right side. The second prisoner carried in to meet him couldn't keep his eyes off the pool of blood, though that perhaps had something to do with the fact that he was bound even closer to it than his predecessor. The only problem was that he didn't know shit. Nor the next, or the one after that. In fact, Trapp was already almost a third of the way through the stack of files, and the blood was only just starting to congeal. The little notepad he'd set alongside the folder in front of him, a ballpoint pen resting diagonally on top of it, was still empty. He watched as his latest appointment was brought in. The only advantage of the repeated interrogations was that, despite their present lack of success, he was at least getting the chance to refine his technique.
"You want a coffee?"
He rubbed his eyelids as the interrogation room's gloom seemed to press down on his shoulders.
"I could use one myself. I think it's the lack of natural light in here."
"I don't drink coffee. It is haram."
"Hey, your English is great. Okay, fine, no coffee. What about water?"
The inmate straightened as much as the chains would allow. It seemed to Trapp as though it was done with a sense of pride.
"I am. Was an English teacher. And I'm not thirsty."
He was talking, which Trapp took as a good sign. Most of the others had either kept their mouths clamped shut, or instead, their eyes had darted nervously around the room, often drifting across the masked face of the guard standing behind him. It was no surprise. Trapp suspected that everything said in this room would be reported back to Abdul the moment the session was over. Or Abdul was listening in. That option would be more efficient, though Trapp didn't voice his suspicion. Still, he wanted to put his new friend at ease. He twisted in his seat and eyed the guard.
"Well, I could use a pick-me-up. I've been at this for hours. You mind?"
When the guard started to lift his radio off his belt, Trapp shook his head.
"You get it. And one for yourself while you're at it. I take it black, no sugar."
"What do you want? I don't know who planned the breakout. I promise you, I didn't even leave the prison grounds."
Trapp frowned with surprise. He opened the man's file, but found that it was sparse. Little more than a photo, the man's name, processing dates, and a list of cell numbers that presumably corresponded to where he'd stayed. He'd been incarcerated for 5 years. The last two of those had been in Al-Shakiri's cell.
You didn't? Really?
You sound surprised.
Wouldn't you be?
Trapp knew full well that Haidar hadn't remained in his cell.
Okay, I'll bite. Why didn't you try and escape?
I am an honest man. I was never guilty of the crimes I was accused of committing. But I was sentenced. I respected my sentence.
So you stayed inside your cell?
He was passing a test he didn't even know he'd been given.
Must have been terrifying.
No. When the others escaped, I went with them. I wanted to see my daughters again. My wife. I don't even know if they're alive.
Trapp leaned forward.
But you didn't go through with it. You had the chance. Many others did. Even from your own cell.
Maybe I should have. How can I ever look my daughters in the eye again, knowing that I could have seen them again? If only I had crossed through that hole in the walls. Will they ever forgive me?
I can't answer that. Tell me what held you back.
I told you already. I am not guilty. In fact, the guards here never accused me of a crime. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, just trying to fetch water, when I was captured and brought to that prison. I am not guilty. But when it came to it, I respected my sentence.
Trapp leaned back, impressed by the moral character of the kind of man who would tread such a path, assuming, of course, that it was true. He flipped open the other folder in front of him, revealing a page-sized photograph of Al-Shakiri face down. It was the first time he'd made it this far with any of them. He turned it over and slid it toward Haidar.
Do you know this man?
Of course.
Why do you say that?
I was in a cell with him for months. Longer. I don't know how long.
2 years.
Haidar's shoulders slumped.
If you say so.
What is his name?
I don't know.
You say you were in a cell with this man for 2 years and you can't tell me his name?
Haidar's eyes flashed.
You said it was 2 years, not me. Besides, why should I tell you anything?
Trapp paused a moment to consider his response. He sensed that bribery wasn't the correct path here. Every inmate ever sentenced proclaimed that they were innocent, and yet miraculously, in this case, he suspected it was the truth.
His name is Khaled Al-Shakiri. He's a very dangerous man. I'm trying to find him before he hurts somebody.
Haidar tensed at the mention of Al-Shakiri's name.
You know him?
I've heard the name before.
He fell silent. Trapp didn't have to ask before what.
So you know what kind of man he is?
I do.
Then you know I need to find him. Will you help me?
He held his breath as he waited for a response. He had conducted many interrogations across a long career, and there was always a moment when the subject decided to cooperate or not. Trapp sensed he had reached it.
I can't help you. Mostly he spoke to the big man, Omar. I knew he was in charge. But I tried to keep myself to myself in there. Many of the other prisoners were unpleasant men. We only spoke once. He seemed pleasant, well-read. I didn't know who he really was then.
The metal door at the other end of the interrogation room squealed open. The guard appeared holding a cup of coffee, bracketed in the doorframe. Trapp held up a hand to forestall him.
What did he say?
A commotion echoed through the open doorway after he asked his question, and Trapp wanted the door closed to block the source out, but not enough to distract Haidar from speaking.
He just talked about home. He said he would go back there. I laughed, told him that this was the only home he would ever know. But he was insistent. He said that he would be back. He really seemed to believe it.
Raised voices grew louder and carried with them the unmistakable tone of argument.
Did he say where home was?
Trapp's eyes flicked to the door, then back. Haidar was distracted. He kept looking at the door and seemed anxious. The spell was broken.
Anything you can remember, just tell me. You know the kind of guy Al-Shakiri is, what he's capable of. You can help me put him away.
Indonesia is...
The door to the interrogation room started to open further, hinges squealing from the force with which it was pushed. Haidar shut down instantly, clamping his mouth shut. He retreated in on himself.
Damn it, why now of all times?
He got his answer a moment later. General Espinosa stormed through the door, practically pushing the SDF guard out of his way. Madison trailed behind him.
Trap!
Espinosa's face was red with anger. He pointed toward the door.
Pack your bags and get the hell out of my sight. You're gone.
Trap gave Haidar an apologetic glance, hoping that Espinosa hadn't blown the entire interrogation. Once they got talking, subjects rarely thought about stopping, unless they were given an opportunity, neatly ribbon-tied, to reconsider whether it was really in their best interests. He stood and moved toward the door, passing the general's outstretched finger without reacting and not stopping until he was on the other side. The unexpected paucity of his response seemed to briefly take the wind out of Espinosa's sails. The three of them reassembled on the other side. Trap got his shot in first.
General, he's talking.
He didn't want his voice to carry through the warehouse's thin, corrugated iron walls.
I don't know what he knows, but I'm certain we want to find out. Let me do my job.
The moment the words left his mouth, he sensed that he had said something wrong. Espinosa turned even more red than he was before.
I didn't ask you here, Trap, but I'm damn sure going to be the one who orders you to leave. I lost good guys out there. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
Of course it does, General.
Trap knew the officer wasn't in his right mind. Grief was talking, not good sense. This was Special Forces. Espinosa would have known the men he ordered into battle far more intimately than any ordinary commander.
Eddie Muniz was my friend. I've known him for years. Since he was just a kid starting out in the army, I never wanted him to die. If it could have been me in his place, I would have traded gladly. But he knew the risks, just like I do.
I don't give a shit.
Espinosa seemed to hear criticism in Trap's words rather than compassion.
You're done here, Trap, both of you. My people will take it from here. Langley's already been told. They concur with my assessment. You're on the next ride out of here, and if you think this is an ass-chewing, you have no idea what's coming. Now get out of my sight.
The chopper ride from Syria to the Iraqi Al-Harir airbase and the subsequent civilian passenger turboprop journey to the sprawling Al Udeid airbase in Doha, Qatar, left little opportunity for Madison and Trapp to debrief on what each of them had learned. Nor did the trip afford the privacy in which to do so. Trapp had little doubt that eyes and ears on the various aircraft had been instructed to report anything they said back to General Espinosa. The man was angry, but he wasn't an idiot. It wasn't until they landed in Qatar, where they waited for the next C-17 back to the United States, operated by the 816th Expeditionary Airlift Squadron, that they found the opportunity to speak. At least, Trap did. As they sweated in 100-degree heat on the concrete floor of a tan-painted hardened aircraft hangar that wasn't equipped with air conditioning, but did have Wi-Fi, Madison pulled out her laptop.
You aren't worried about that thing overheating?
She didn't respond to his lame joke as her fingers sped across the keyboard. The computer's speakers emitted a continuous series of chimes as her email inbox connected with the agency's secure servers.
What'd you learn?
Not much.
Trap filled her in on what he'd learned from the truncated interview. He suspected there was more that Haidar might have told him, but no smoking gun.
So Haidar said Indonesia?
Madison put up a note-taking app on her laptop and typed a quick note.
That's worth looking into.
You ever been?
No.
It's a big place. Covers a tenth of the world's landmass. At least it feels that way. Doesn't narrow things down much at all.
That's a long shot, but we need to cover our bases.
Did you get anything?
Trap slumped back against the concrete base of the hangar's wall.
One other thing. I need a favor.
Shoot.
You and Abdul seem to have an understanding. I think he'd take another look at the last guy I interviewed. I have his inmate number.
To what end?
He's not guilty of anything other than being picked up in the wrong place at the wrong time. He served 5 years for that crime. I'd like to see him walk. If not that, he should at least get his own cell. For his protection as much as anything else. If word gets out that he talked...
He didn't need to explain what would happen next.
I can ask.
It was impossible to get comfortable no matter how he shifted his position against the wall. He twisted his frame yet again.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No problem. I think I've got something, though I'm not sure what.
Go on.
It might just be rumor, but a couple of the guys I interviewed remembered Al-Shaqiri. From before, not just Al-Shaddadi. It seems that he was assigned to some secretive operational cell.
Doing what?
Best guess? International terrorism. Shock and awe kind of shit. You remember back in the Caliphate's peak, there was a series of terror scares? Explosives hidden in printers and laptops and that kind of thing? The idea was to ship them in aircraft cargo bays and have them detonate at 30,000 feet.
Madison dove her flattened palm toward the ground.
Rings a bell. But I don't remember they had much luck. Mowing down pedestrians with a truck on a leafy boulevard in Nice isn't exactly 9/11.
Rumor is, the NSA had them penetrated from day one. We were two steps ahead of them the entire time. That's why they had to resort to lone wolf attacks like Nice.
So that was Al-Shaqiri's gig?
Not exactly. Seems he took over later on, after the worst of the previous cell's failures. After that, things went quiet. No attacks, but not because of anything we did.
You think he was planning something big?
That was Trapp's operating assumption. The attack that had cost Nunez's life confirmed that for him.
I do. I managed to get a list of three names, all known to have worked closely with Al-Shaqiri in the last few months of the Territorial Caliphate. All three of them were engineers.
She double-clicked her laptop trackpad, then turned the screen so that he could see it.
This guy, Mizr Khan, graduated the College of Aeronautical Engineering in Rasalpur, Pakistan in 2014, confirmed killed in the fall of Raqqa. The other two are whereabouts unknown, likely dead, but we have no way of knowing for sure. Record keeping wasn't exactly top of mind when the coalition was pounding ISIS into dust.
What do we know about him?
I'll spare you the gory details. One dropped out of Al-Furat al-Awsat Technical University in Najaf, Iraq. The other graduated second in his class at the National School of Civil Aviation in Toulouse, France.
There's a common thread.
Trapp felt enlivened by the information, even if he didn't yet see where it led.
Yup, all aerospace. My best guess is they were identifying weak points in passenger aircraft, where to place explosives for maximum effect, that kind of thing. But that's all it is, a guess. Anyway, it's likely they're all dead. The question is, did they finish their work before we slotted them?
The pace of incoming messages to the laptop, at least judged by the irritating series of chimes, slowed as both fell silent to digest her question. It was replaced by a piercing whistle from an Air Force crew chief, who waved at them from the opposite side of the hangar, then jerked his thumb toward the runway.
Looks like our ride's here.
Trapp's exhaustion returned after a brief flurry of excitement generated by Madison's revelations. There was definitely something here, but it was thin at best. A link to Indonesia, maybe something to do with passenger aviation. Whatever the through line was, it was harder to decipher than the Zodiac letters. Madison's computer pinged one last time. She stood up, carrying it in one hand and swinging her rucksack over her opposite shoulder. Trapp grabbed her bags along with his duffel, which he'd barely had the opportunity to unzip, let alone unpack. His longer stride carried him a few steps ahead of her. Her eyes were glued to the laptop screen. The C-17's engines began spooling up behind him.
Wait, I think I've got something.
Tell him that.
Trapp jerked his thumb at the Air Force NCO with the whistle.
Because I get the sense he doesn't plan on sticking around.
I'm serious.
So am I.
Trapp took in the crew chief's increasingly frantic gesticulations. He grabbed Madison's arm.
Fill me in en route.
They boarded and were unceremoniously shown to a row of airline-style passenger seats bolted onto the Globemaster's floor and sandwiched between lines of large steel cargo pallets. In lieu of a business-class-style amenities kit, they found two sets of ear defenders lying on their seats. Trapp wondered if Espinosa had arranged for a treatment this Spartan, or whether the Air Force's logisticians were just having a particularly bad day.
Better get comfortable.
The warning tone for the C-17's rear door sounded.
Gonna be a long flight.
Mm-hmm.
Madison glanced around to see if anyone was listening in, then appeared to decide that the airmen and women tightening straps and checking cargo would be unable to hear what she said over the aircraft's powerful jet engines.
I got a bulletin a couple days ago from the MIT, the Turkish Security Services.
I know them, but damned if I can pronounce their real name.
It's National Intelligence Organization.
That easy, huh? So what's eating them?
I put flags on all of al-Shaqiri's known associates a while back, no matter how tenuous the link and wherever they are in the world. At least, where those locations correspond with friendly or semi-friendly intelligence agencies.
Trapp knew that U.S. relations with Turkey generally, and the Turkish MIT in particular, had been flaky for some time. The Turks likely only shared intelligence so they could be seen to do so, which meant information they deemed unimportant. But then the same could be said of the CIA.
And we got a hit. A week or so ago, two men known to have run with al-Shaqiri lost their tails and disappeared. The MIT was only checking in on them a couple days a week, often by video link. Too many potential targets mixed in among all those Syrian refugees. By the time they realized they were in the wind, it was too late to track them.
Anyone I recognize?
Just nobodies. At least that's what we thought.
Any idea what they plan on doing?
None. Just that they're gone. For 5 years, they've been living in Turkey, getting into no trouble.
And the week al-Shaqiri goes missing,
they disappear right along with him.
Both fell silent for a moment as the windowless cargo aircraft swung around a turn as it proceeded across the runway. The metal cargo pallets creaked from the momentum. The plane stopped and started to build up engine power, trembling slightly as the jet thrust battled with the landing gear's brakes. Then the plane started rolling.
Hell of a coincidence.
Yeah, if you believe in that kind of thing.
The man shivered in the pitch darkness. His eyes were open, but he saw nothing except for vague shapes, brief flashes of white and color as his brain struggled to make sense of the endless nothingness around him. There was another in there with him. He smelled familiar, an old friend. In the background, there was a harsh chemical stink and a strange vibration that never seemed to ease.
We're almost there.
His friend's voice was caring. He stroked the sick man's hair, which the latter realized was in his lap. He was lying on his friend.
Don't give up now. Not now we've come all this way.
He knew they had traveled a great distance, though in that moment he was sure neither how far, nor either the names of their destination or port of embarkation. All he remembered was that they were engaged on a mission of great importance, something that would change the world. His friend dipped a cloth into a pail of water, wrung it out, and wiped the sweat from his forehead. For a moment, he felt cool, but then the shivering returned. He was burning up. Suddenly, the darkness was vanquished by a bright glow. The sick man instinctively squeezed his eyes shut as a peal of agony surged through his mind. The beam of light danced around the narrow space. His friend held his head gently as he maneuvered himself out from underneath him.
It's going to be okay, Khaled.
That's right. They had to stay quiet. The journey had lasted several days already, during which they had barely spoken to one another, only barely even tasted fresh air. But where were they? And who were they hiding from? He screwed his eyes tighter shut as he battled for understanding. The answers were in his mind somewhere, but try as he might, he couldn't reach for them. Another wave of nausea swept through him.
I'm going to give you another dose before we move. It will help.
It was too early, wasn't it? But his friend's voice was so compelling, and he hurt. Everything hurt. His stomach, his head, every limb. It was as though he was wearing a blanket of lava, the heat searing every inch of exposed skin. Slowly, haltingly, the man opened his eyes. The world wobbled in front of him, a fit of dizziness overcoming him so powerfully, he thought that an earthquake must be shaking the world beneath him. A word that his friend had spoken echoed in his mind.
Khaled.
That was his name. He remembered now what they were doing and why he needed to live to see it brought to fruition. He watched as the beam of Omar's flashlight danced across the small space. The man moved excruciatingly slowly, always careful not to knock into the corrugated steel that formed three of the four walls that imprisoned them. Noise would kill them both. A small cool box was stacked on top of a larger one at the far end of the space. Omar moved slowly toward it, able to stand fully upright, yet needing to keep his body hunched to avoid knocking into the walls. He lifted the lid and extracted a plastic pouch from inside, along with a length of clear medical tubing. He knelt by his friend's side, pulling a rubber cap from the end of the line and attaching it to the cannula, running into a vein on the back of Khaled's hand. Omar lifted the pouch and hooked it onto a bracket that was screwed into the steel above. It hung there, feeding desperately needed intravenous antibiotics into Khaled's bloodstream.
See? Better already.
Khaled looked up at his friend, marveling at how their roles had reversed. For so long, he had been the leader, and Omar his flock, despite their disparity in both physical size and prowess. In the cell they had shared for so many years, he was the one who had first brokered the uneasy truce between the various inmates that had allowed them to thrive as a community, hanging together instead of hanging apart. Omar had enforced that truce when necessary, but it had rarely proven so. That was his doing. He had found a group of lost souls and given them purpose. But now, Omar led him. The escape from al-Shaddadi was Khaled's idea, but Omar was the one who had made it happen. He had practically carried Khaled over the wall in his arms, driven the vehicle that had spirited them to freedom, taken him to the doctor to have his long-ignored wounds cared for. And he still cared for him now. Khaled reached up and gripped his friend's stained t-shirt.
If I die, you need to see it through.
That won't happen. Allah will see to that.
I do not judge his will. If he sees fit to take me, then I will go willingly. But the mission must succeed. You know that. And other than me, you are the only one who knows every detail. So it must be you.
You won't die. Stop talking this way. You need your strength.
Khaled grew quiet for a few seconds. His friend shook with repressed emotion. He looked as though he wanted to scream, which would be a natural enough reaction after the horrors they'd both survived over the previous 5 years, not to mention the stresses and torments of just the past few days. He watched as Omar slowly relaxed.
But if I do, you'll do as I ask. I need to know, Omar. Give me the strength I need to continue.
You know the answer already.
Thank you.
The two men drifted into silence, at first tense, then companionable. Khaled stopped sweating, at least for a time. His fever felt as though it was breaking, though it had given him many false dawns before. Perhaps the antibiotics were finally beginning to win their battle against the tiny devils in his bloodstream. He was certain that the fight inside him was between good and evil, as was the struggle to which he'd committed his adult life. He was not, of course, an educated man. He understood the basics of germ theory, of bacteria, genetics, DNA, and all the various intellectual building blocks of modern society. But his understanding of the world was also a more ancient one. There were things that humankind's science could not explain, and those realms could only be attributed to Allah and, no doubt, his nemesis, Satan. But Khaled knew which force was stronger. The only question was whether Allah would see fit to save him or whether he had other plans. Neither outcome concerned him greatly. His only purpose in this life was to see that Allah's will was done. Omar tapped him gently on the leg, lifting his index finger to his lips and gesturing for silence. Khaled complied instantly. Even during the glory days of the Islamic Caliphate, when he'd led large paramilitary task forces, he'd known to trust Omar's instincts. The large man was a natural soldier. He was as proficient with firearms, blades, and explosives as any Western Special Forces operator, and combined those skills with a natural, unerring nose for trouble. It took him another 10 seconds to detect the sound that had alerted his friend. Even then, the sound of footsteps on the iron decking outside was scarcely audible. He lifted his hand and rested his palm against the cool steel. It was dripping with condensation as the relatively chilled air within the container came into contact with the warm tropical heat on the outside. It was barely an inch thick. That was all that separated their hiding place from the sailors who worked on the other side. Those sailors rarely came down into the cargo compartments. That was what their contacts had promised. And experience had shown that it was the truth. The problem wasn't that the rare visits happened, but rather that it was impossible to know when they might occur. Sailors got bored. There was little to do at sea. Every day they had heard a thumping on the deck outside at the exact same time and puzzled over it for hours. It wasn't until the third repetition that Khaled figured it out. Someone was going for a run, and apparently they chose not to use the treadmills in the container ship's tiny onboard gymnasium. Or else the fitness equipment on the Malaysian-flagged rust bucket was out of order. In fact, that was likely. But this new sound was different, quieter. Perhaps the individual responsible had a slight build, or maybe he was walking far away and the sound was somehow traveling through the ship's steel floor. Or someone rapped against the steel container's exterior. Three times, then a pause, then three times more. It was the signal. They had arrived. Even though both men had been expecting it, they flinched. They had spent several days in almost complete darkness and silence as Khaled sweated through a vicious infection, likely septicemia. The tension that had built was almost indescribable. All that was left to occupy either mind, at least for Khaled when he was conscious, was daydreaming of everything that could go wrong. Omar reacted first. He lifted his hand, formed a fist, then hesitated. Khaled nodded. He rapped his knuckles against the corrugated steel, just once, as they had agreed. Nothing happened for a few seconds. Footsteps echoed around the container. Omar stood, quickly maneuvering himself toward the end where the cool boxes and other supplies that had sustained them through the long journey were stacked. He squatted, rummaging inside one of them before emerging with an object in his hand, a knife. On one side, the blade was smooth and sharp before tapering to a vicious point. The other was ridged like a saw. It was 7 or more inches long, sufficient to reach deep inside a man and gut his organs. Khaled had seen it done. He had seen Omar do it. He prayed he would not have to see it done again. He took no pleasure in causing the deaths of other Muslims. It was a sin, though one he was sure that Allah would forgive in service of his greater goal. The bolts on the front end of the container were being tugged open. Khaled winced, fearing that others would hear the sound and investigate, despite knowing that it was unlikely that one such sound would draw any attention whatsoever on a vessel where such noises were common at every hour of the day and night. The bolts were pulled back and down. He detected the faintest change in pressure as the doors were pulled open and air rushed toward the exit. Then footsteps inside the container. Omar positioned himself beside the entrance to their hiding place within the container. It was 2/3 the width of a door and about the height of a man's waist. On the other side of the wall was plaster, in front of which stood racks of refrigerated medical supplies. It would, should, be impossible to spot, even if you knew it was there. He stood over it with the weapon poised to strike. Acquiring a refrigerated container had been hard work. But surviving the first part of the long waterborne odyssey, sailing out of the Persian Gulf into the Arabian Sea, in 100-degree heat inside an airless steel box, would have been suicide. Especially after a surgery to remove the fragments of shrapnel that had scarred him so long ago. Desperately needed, and yet an equally desperate risk. The container had been modified by a friendly engineer. The far end pulled forward just enough to create a hiding space, and not so shallow as to draw attention. The man had been smart. He'd known that it was easy for the eye to miss inconsistencies that sat below its ordinary level. And if it made a forced entry a little more difficult for the attacker, that was only a benefit. Khaled pictured his friend bringing the blade down in a fast, vicious strike on an unsuspecting customs inspector's neck. It would sever spinal column and arteries alike. The victim would die without ever seeing the face of the man who had killed him. Khaled's mouth was parched. He needed water. The fever was back. Whoever was on the other side of the plastered and painted drywall knew the correct sequence. But that didn't mean they were who they said they were. Men were imperfect beings. Even those who professed to be resolutely committed to their faith, who claimed they would give everything in the service of their religion, could break when confronted by earthly consequences. That was the hand of Satan at work. It was the implacable force against which Khaled al-Shakiri fought so hard. He was Allah's servant. He was the hand of God. Water was all he could think of now, as the fever raged inside him. The doctor they had consulted after the prison break had told him that he wouldn't survive the coming journey and all its hardships without surgery to remove the shrapnel fragments. One was perilously close to an arterial blood vessel in his intestines. It was a miracle, the doctor had said, that he'd survived this long. The doctor had put it down to Khaled's sedentary life inside the prison, but he knew better. It was Allah's hand at work. He raised his hand to signal Omar, momentarily forgetting where he was and what was happening around him. He tried to speak, but his throat was too parched to form words. He was so thirsty. Khaled heard scratching, then a scrape as something heavy was moved. Items toppled onto the container's floor. Then a louder crash as a hammer smashed against the drywall, puncturing it and emerging through the other side. Both stowaways stared at it, watched it withdraw, then once more cut through the thin wall with ease. Over and over again, the man wielding it beat the drywall down. Finding his way back to consciousness, Khaled feared that someone would stumble across them at any moment. And finally, it was done. A head poked through. It was swathed in dark hair, its cheeks coated white and panting hard from the exertion. Its owner looked right, meeting Khaled's glazed eyes, then left. He saw Omar's legs first and followed them upward, flinching as he saw the knife poised above him and ready to strike.
What is the password?
The Surat.
Which one?
Al-Fatih.
Khaled closed his eyes. He recited the Quranic verse known as Surat al-Fath in his head.
Surely those who pledge allegiance to you, O Prophet, are actually pledging allegiance to Allah. Allah's hand is over theirs. Whoever breaks their pledge, it will only be to their loss. And whoever fulfills their pledge to Allah, he will grant them a great reward.
It is time.
The sailor with the hammer nodded. Neither man had met him before. Their contact was the ship's captain, and he could not move around the vessel as easily without drawing attention. His role was to organize the crew so that they never came to notice the precious cargo they carried in their midst. Khaled noticed with some surprise that his friend gestured to him.
He is weak. You must help me carry him.
The sailor nodded.
We must hurry. The captain has stopped the ship's engines for a few moments, but we don't have long.
The plane. Is it waiting for us?
I don't know anything about that. All I was told was to get you down to the boat.
Khaled caught flashes of medication boxes on either side as they manhandled him out of the hiding place and through the container. Then rusted steel as they half-carried, half-dragged him through the aging ship's gangways.
What plane?
The plan he had labored over for so many years returned slowly to him. They'd traveled overland through Syria and Iraq. A container ship had carried them from the Persian Gulf to Pakistan, and an ambulance plane would carry them the rest of the way. The journey already had cost the better part of a week, and there was still much hardship to come. But every step of the way, true believers had helped smooth their path. Even after so long, after so many false dawns and broken promises, they were still out there. It was sunrise when they emerged into the open air. The sky was clear, and the most glorious ochre warmed the base of the horizon as the sun broke on a new day. As Khaled locked his eyes on the ball of fire rising from the east, he found himself unable to breathe. It was surely a message of divine favor. For though it was still many thousands of miles distant, he knew what lay at the very end of the path. Home. The Air Force bird carried Trapp and Madison to the enormous U.S. military hub at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, where they boarded a regularly scheduled Patriot Express 737 that touched down at Joint Base Andrews almost 28 hours after their journey began. The DOD-contracted commercial airliner even offered its passengers booze, which was a risky move given that most of those on board were Army enlisted. But neither of them were in the mood for drinking.
I feel like crap. I think I would kill someone for a shower. At least maim somebody.
Yeah.
Trapp didn't feel a whole lot better than she did. His attention, though, was consumed by a black sedan that was sitting on the runway. Its driver, a trim man with close-cropped blonde hair wearing a dark suit, leaned against the hood. He was wearing shades, despite the thick band of murky cloud that sat in the sky overhead.
You might have to.
Madison noticed where his gaze was focused.
Well, that screams government, wouldn't you say?
I guess we should get it over with.
Yeah, I could have really used that shower.
The drive to Langley via the Beltway, then the Richmond Highway, hugging the Potomac most of the way, took about an hour. The traffic was first thick, and then it inexplicably disappeared. Trapp looked at the driver.
You got a name?
He was CIA, that much was certain. Most likely from the agency's Security Protective Service. They were the guys who protected the director, and apparently they also ran errands like this.
Mark.
A real one?
He didn't get a response to that. They entered the Langley compound through a side gate that was no less secure than the main entrance. Despite the fact that they had an escort, Trapp was still forced to stare at a facial recognition camera. It was no less janky than when the devices had been first installed almost 5 years earlier. By the time Mark, or whatever he was really called, pulled the car up in visitor parking, it was almost dark. He climbed out quickly and opened the door for Madison, who smiled her thanks.
Hey, Mark, you mind telling me what all this is about?
Not my job.
She pasted her most disarming smile on her face and gently brushed his arm. It was a remarkably familiar gesture, the kind that female operatives were trained to use at the farm, though Trapp knew that Madison, as an analyst, had never taken such a course. She was all natural.
At least tell me who you're taking us to see. I mean, look at me. I look like I've been dragged through a cornfield by my hair. I just want to make a good impression, that's all. You know how it is.
It wasn't the way the Trapp would have gone about extracting the information, but it worked.
Mr. Richards told me to bring you to him.
As in the head of the terrorism desk? I'm either in a lot of trouble or about to get a promotion. Let's hope it's the latter.
That's the guy.
Trapp kept quiet. He was pretty sure that Richards wasn't Madison's direct boss. It wasn't a good sign, that was for sure. On the other hand, he didn't care much for bureaucratic dick-swinging right now, not after everything that had happened.
Great. Hey, one other thing. You mind if we go through the lobby? I just want to pay my respects. It's a personal tradition. You understand, right?
It was the second time that she'd used the same trick, but it seemed to work. Though maybe it wasn't really a trick after all. The gold stars in Langley's lobby held an outsized importance in the mind of every last one of its employees. They were a daily reminder of the ultimate sacrifice made by those who put their lives on the line, as well as the consequences of screwing up.
Sure.
The marble-floored lobby was busy despite the late hour. Trapp paused for a second as he stepped over the agency's eagle-headed seal and realized that he'd fallen in step with Mark, who appeared equally unwilling to interrupt Madison's private tradition. The memorial wall glowed on the opposite side of the space, almost seeming to beckon him toward it. He hadn't been this close since they'd added Ryan's star. Madison stopped in front of the goatskin-bound memorial book. She reached out to it hesitantly before turning the pages with great reverence. She stopped when she found the one she was looking for and dragged her finger hesitantly across the paper. She read the inscription above her.
In honor of those members of the Central Intelligence Agency who gave their lives in service of their country.
Trapp knew it by heart. Ryan's wasn't the first memorial service he'd attended. it was unlikely to be the last. There were 139 stars on that wall now, more with every passing year. The brothers he'd lost weren't named in that book, though their star was engraved forevermore on the marble above. And if he were to one day fall beside them, neither would his. He would remain classified in death as in life. Trapp found himself by her side. He didn't really remember walking over. Madison's eyes gleamed with emotion, and she was unwilling to disturb the peace of the place.
We'll get the bastard.
Trapp didn't face her as he said the words. He focused instead on just one of those marble indentations, the last resting place of the best man he'd ever known.
Sure we will.
Before they entered Clark Richards' office, Madison told him that she would handle things. This was her case, so Trapp was happy to defer to her judgment. Well, not happy. He wanted to push Clark Richards against a wall and tell him to get the fuck out of the way so they could do their jobs. But it was Madison's case, her call. So he just stewed beside her.
What the fuck were you thinking?
Richards was a man of average height, build, and complexion. He wore a neatly trimmed beard, the kind that had become popular over the past few years. Trapp guessed he'd chosen his glasses after watching Ben Affleck in Argo.
What do you mean?
Richards looked at her, his eyes flashing from behind those large, square glasses.
Who authorized you to go into combat? Because it certainly wasn't my office.
It wasn't something I did intentionally. I couldn't have known that Al-Shaddadi prison was going to be attacked on that day.
Oh, we'll get to that.
Trapp said quietly. He'd taken an instant dislike to Richards. There was something about the Central Intelligence Agency, or maybe any large bureaucracy, that allowed second-rate individuals like him to rise through its ranks. They were desk warriors, trained mainly in the art of forging razor-sharp memos and using them to stab their fellow candidates for promotion in the back. Even in the National Clandestine Service, the agency's operational arm, the waters were fouled with seaweed of his kind. But there was less of it to cut through, especially in the Special Operations Group, Trapp's real home. The intelligence arm, which was home to analysts like Madison, was a different kettle of fish.
You could have been killed. Imagine how that would reflect on the department.
Syria is a war zone, sir.
In case you hadn't noticed.
Trapp detected her subtext. He wondered if Richards had also.
Oh, believe me, I am aware. My office will be closely examining how you were able to worm your way in there. Protocols exist for a reason.
The muscle on Madison's jaw pulsed intensely. Trapp could tell that she was not giving voice to what she truly wanted to say, in case it rebounded to her disadvantage. Richard seemed like the kind of man who would stand in the way of good intelligence work only to prove a point.
Can I brief you on what we've learned, sir?
How did you miss an impending attack on this scale?
Richards removed his glasses, extracted a polishing cloth from his jacket's interior pocket, and began to clean them.
It is acutely embarrassing.
I thought you didn't want me there in the first place, sir.
She was clearly unable to hold her tongue any longer.
Well, if you had to be there, you might as well be useful.
I was working on how we missed it when I was ordered to return to Washington, sir. If there's blame to be apportioned, I'll be the first to put my hand up and accept it.
Unlike you, Richards.
This wasn't a debrief, it was a shit-shoveling session, and Richards wanted to make sure it didn't land on him. Anger flickered inside Trapp's chest. He wanted nothing more than to punch the insufferable desk jockey in the middle of that smart face.
For now, what we know for certain is that this was meticulously planned. I became aware of insurgent chatter referring to someone or something known as the Hand of God in the weeks leading up to the attack. I traced that chatter back to its source, Khalid al-Shaqiri, when the attack took place. I was just a few hours too late.
Her face displayed genuine anguish at the lives lost as a result of her perceived failure. Trapp knew it was nothing of the sort. You couldn't prevent every attack, no matter how hard you tried. It was a miracle that Madison had come as close as she had.
And you let him get away.
That remark confirmed Trapp's guess as to the purpose of the meeting.
What's important now is finding him, sir.
Madison opened a manila file folder on her lap.
I have reason to believe that his escape was in service of some larger plan.
You'll hand off your work to another analyst. My office will be in touch with the details in due course.
Sir, this could be time critical.
Richards replaced his glasses and peered down at Madison.
Miss Grubb, I'm not presently minded to place much weight on your analysis.
Trapp stood up. Richards looked up at him, his eyes startled behind those ridiculous, thick-rimmed frames.
Well, you should be. Without her, we wouldn't know anything at all.
And what do we know? Because so far, I'm not hearing anything.
Oh, shut the fuck up.
Trapp luxuriated in the shocked expression that appeared on the department head's face. He stepped toward the man's desk, looming over him.
You're not hearing because you're not listening. Well, here's the thing. We have a senior ISIS commander who engineered a daring escape from prison. His known associates are dropping off the grid after years of inactivity. You know what that smells like to me? It smells like they're planning something big. And I sure wouldn't want to be the asshole hauled up in front of Congress for missing it when the shit inevitably hits the fan. It tends to be a bad career move. You know what I'm talking about. Don't you, Clark?
Trapp eased himself back into his seat and adopted a more reasonable tone.
So, here's the thing. I can write up what I just said in a memo. And you know, I'm no wordsmith, but I've been working here long enough to have a real thick Rolodex, so to speak. Somewhere in there, I'm pretty sure I have the director's email address. A memo like that could have wide circulation. Not the kind of document that's easy to sweep under the rug. You choose.